This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Flint Taylor from the Chicago People's Law Office on the infamous torture cases.
Torture didn't happen just in Guantanamo. It happened right here in Chicago.
We'll hear from a recent speech by Max Blumenthal on the Middle East peace process.
Max is the author of the recent book Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. He speaks with firsthand knowledge, having spent several years in Israel interviewing the main players.
Professor Jim Petras joins us to discuss U.S. and European violent seizure of the Ukraine.
The stakes are heavy as the United States continues to surround Russia militarily, economically, and politically.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We speak with Chicago attorney Flint Taylor, senior partner at the People's Law Office. Attorney Taylor was principally involved in the Chicago torture cases going back 40 years. Chicago Police Commander John Burge, who learned his torture techniques in Vietnam and who was responsible for sending to prison 120 African-American Chicago victims, is now in prison. The city of Chicago continues to fight compensating those men who were tortured by Burge and others in his command. Taylor will discuss the proposed bill in Chicago City Council to compensate some of these victims, as well as tell us of the story of ex-Mayor Richard Daley covering up for his nephew when he murdered a man in downtown Chicago. Flint Taylor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's good to be back, Mike.
Well, Flint, we haven't talked to you in over 6 months, and I know there's a lot of developments that our listeners want to get brought up to date on. But for those who are not familiar with the story, I want you to just, in a brief way, tell us about John Burge, the policeman on the southwest side of Chicago, came back from Vietnam, tortured people over there, brought back his equipment and his know-how, and was doing that to almost 100, I think, black men, false confessions in prison, and so on. And then you got involved in litigation. And the city of Chicago did whatever it could to cover it up, and they lost that battle. Stuff is still coming out. And I wanted you to bring our listeners, tell them what happened with Burge initially, and bring them up to date, and then we'll talk about the latest developments.
Well, this is a scandal that's gone on for more than 40 years now in Chicago. Burge came back from Vietnam, and he was quickly made a detective on the south side of Chicago in the early 70s, and he started to use electric shock, bagging people to suffocate them, mock executions, all the kinds of torture techniques that you hear about in third world countries and that kind of thing, but not here in this country as much, hopefully. But he tortured over the next 20 years, we now documented around 120 African-American men, and in the way that I just mentioned. And those men, many were sent to the penitentiary, some to death row. Many of them gave false confessions. All of them confessed under the torture techniques. And during this 20-year period, Burge was promoted from detective to sergeant to lieutenant to commander. During this period of time, in the 80s, the prosecutor, the state's attorney of Cook County, was Richie Daley, Richard M. Daley, who went on to be mayor, of course. And this evidence was presented to him early on by the superintendent of police, and they decided to cover it all up rather than to pursue Burge. And because of that, the torture went on for another 10 or 15 years. And because of that, the cover-up was at the highest levels of the state's attorney's office and later of the city of Chicago. And over the years, we were able to unpry case by case and link by link the evidence that showed this pattern and practice of torture. Burge was fired in the 90s, but he was never prosecuted until the critical mass of evidence reached a peak in the mid-2000s. and the U.S. attorney here indicted Burge for obstruction of justice and perjury because he could no longer indict him for torture. And Burge was convicted and sent to penitentiary, where he now serving a 4.5-year sentence with Bernie Madoff down at Butner.
And I understand that the city of Chicago spent about $100 million in defending Burge and others. Is that an accurate figure?
The number keeps going up. It breaks down this way. Burge was able to get private lawyers to represent him and all of the other characters in the menagerie of torture, to get private lawyers appointed and to have the city pay for them. The city's paid over $20 million in defense fees to defend Burge and his cohorts. Another $20 million has gone out, or $22 million now, I think it is, to pensions. Burge still gets his pension down in the penitentiary. And these other officers who have taken the Fifth Amendment and who have been implicated in various cases, they all get their pensions, they get their medical care. That adds up to another 20 or so million. When there's another 65 or so million that's been paid out to some of the men who have been fortunate enough to have lawsuits who were wrongfully convicted by Burge and his associates. And then there's been another $10 to $15 million spent in investigating Burge and prosecuting Burge. So when you add all those numbers up, you get to around $125 million in taxpayers' money that's been spent in this scandal.
Flint, tell us about what's happened in the last several months with respect to these cases.
Well, of course, it was a great victory to get Burge put behind bars, and it was another, every time a man is released, that's another significant victory. And every time a case is settled and a man gets compensation, that's another victory. But there's a lot still going on here. There are still men behind bars all these years based on tortured confessions. We recently got appointed a special master to try to find any men in the penitentiary who haven't had the ability to have a hearing to have their case relitigated based on the torture evidence. That's one thing that was accomplished in the last few months. Another thing is there's an ongoing battle to try to take Burge's pension away. There's no reason that a convicted felon under the pension laws here in this state should be getting his pension while he's serving time for lying about torture. But the pension board granted him the right to keep his pension. So that's being litigated. It's presently pending in front of the Illinois Supreme Court. Another important thing that's going on right now is a grassroots struggle to have an ordinance passed by city council that would set aside $20 million, and we picked that number because of the $20 million that went to Burge's lawyers and because of the pension and all of that, to give compensation to the men who haven't been fortunate enough to bring lawsuits because of the statute of limitations. And that would not only be some kind of compensation for those men, but also would set up medical facilities for them, treatment centers. They would get free education and job training. There would be a memorial set up for the men, and you would have to teach torture and the realities of the torture in the public schools here in the city of Chicago. Amnesty International just joined that struggle and is featuring some of the cases of torture in their campaign here in the United States to fight torture. So it's still going on. There's also a fight in Congress, although this Congress there's not much hope for it, to have a federal statute that would make torture by law enforcement in this country a federal crime, and there'd be no statute of limitations because it's a crime against humanity.
We're speaking with Attorney Flint Taylor in Chicago. He's a partner at the People's Law Office. Flint, I understand that this has all led to the doorstep not just of ex-Mayor Daley, but to his nephew. Could you tell us what's happening on that front?
Well, Daley, as I mentioned, was front and center in the cover-up, both as this prosecutor. He was the elected prosecutor in the 80s, and then he went on to be elected mayor, and in both occasions he was an active participant in covering up the evidence of torture and abuse. Recently, We were able to convince a federal judge to hold Daley as a defendant, a civil defendant, in one of the lawsuits by one of the men who was tortured and wrongfully convicted. That case was settled before Daley was compelled to testify and to tell and to be confronted with his misconduct. But there's another case which, on the face of it, seems unrelated, but also implicates Daley and his family in a major decade-long cover-up, and that's the David Kochman case. And David Kochman was a 21-year-old young college student from the suburbs who had the misfortune of being on Rush Street in Chicago late at night and getting into a verbal altercation with a group of thugs that included the mayor's nephew, with a man by the name of Veneco. Veneco was 6'3 and 230 pounds, and he punched David Kochman square in the face. Kochman went down, hit his head against the curb, and went into a coma and died 12 days later. Because it was the mayor's nephew, a mayor's nephew ran from the scene and they didn't know who it was, but somehow through back channels, Daley and his family let the highest officials in the police department know that it was the mayor's nephew involved, and so a massive cover-up went on in the police department and at the state's attorney's office to make the Kochman, who was 5'5 and 120 pounds, into the aggressor and to therefore not charge Veneco. And that went on through two police investigations, the total fabrication and destroying of files, you name it, everything you could think of in a cover-up went on in this case until finally we were able to get a special prosecutor appointed, and he indicted Veneco last year, and Veneco was ultimately pled guilty and did some time. But during that investigation, the special prosecutor talked to about 300 witnesses, including members of the Daley family, and wrote a long report. Unfortunately, he chose not to indict any of the police or any of the state's attorneys for cover-up, but he released the report, and as a result, we represent the Kochman family, myself and Locke Bowman, and we just recently brought a suit alleging denial of access to the courts with regard to the Kochman family based on the cover-up engineered by the police and the state's attorney's office in conspiracy with the Daley family to make our client's son the aggressor rather than the victim that he was.
It's really breathtaking. You know, Flint, you tease me when I quote Lenny Bruce on this, but I'm going to do it again. But it's true. Chicago is so corrupt, it's thrilling.
Well, I know I do tease you, and it's not so thrilling to us, but it certainly keeps us fighting as hard as we can to try to expose some of this stuff. And we feel like we make progress from time to time, but I guess Lenny Bruce could also be quoted as saying, although this probably was someone else, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And Emmanuel, the new mayor, just like the old mayor, so to speak, he's trying to put a gloss on it, but he's still trying to keep the lid on all of it while, as you mentioned, you know, cutting 50 schools while spending exorbitant sums of money to build a new gymnasium for DePaul and spending money that's supposed to be earmarked for underprivileged communities on big corporate projects. And so we're saying in the ordinance, and we have some support in the city council. It's certainly not the kind of progressive city council that New York has, but here in Chicago, we're trying to get this ordinance passed. We're hopeful to have a full hearing where we can lay all of these facts in front of the city council and the public and say, well, look, if you can pay all this money to defend Burge to cover up, then you certainly can pay some money to the men who put Burge in the penitentiary with their courageous testimony and who are out on the streets without jobs, without any medical care, or having to hustle just to survive. And that kind of contrast just seems morally and politically something that will really have some important impact here in the city.
Well, it would certainly be a plus for our side. When I was recently in Chicago, I learned that the parking meters in Chicago have been sold to a private corporation, and that the Skyway that I took when I drove from Chicago to Detroit, the Skyway was sold to a private corporation. And then I heard that the schools are being privatized like crazy. So if you can win this one and at least get some funds for the right people, you know, more power to you, Flint.
Well, thank you. You know, it is very discouraging the way they're privatizing everything. Of course, a primary thing in terms of our own work is the prisons, and privatizing prisons throughout this country, making them even worse, if that's possible, than they were when they were under state control directly. So, you know, it's a whole economic discussion, and it's one that we really need to fight back against.
We spoke with an attorney in Chicago just 2 weeks ago about how they've privatized medical care in prisons so that the providers of medical care have the incentive to not provide medical care for these people who really have no choice. And it's resulted in a number of deaths, which they just, the corporation that does the medical care, just figures that in to its expenses, having to pay those lawsuits. So things are really going to hell in a handcart. But you're there kind of standing up in front of it, Flint, and we're grateful for you.
We're trying, you know. We're trying to give it the good fight, and we'll continue to do that. We've been doing it now for, it'll be our 45th anniversary of the People's Law Office in August, and let's hope we can keep going and keep fighting these cases.
You've got a website, the People's Law Office, right?
We do, and there's a lot of very interesting stuff about police torture, about the Fred Hampton Black Panther case, which, of course, we were involved in many years ago, and many other topics that are of interest, I think, to people who are concerned about social justice and racism.
Before I say goodbye to you, give us the website.
It's peopleslawoffice.com. Just very simple. Just if you looked up People's Law Office, P-E-O-P-L-E-S, lawoffice.com.
Great. Flint Taylor, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
I always enjoy it, Michael, and you take care now.
You too. Bye-bye. We go now to a recent speech by author and reporter Max Blumenthal, who's recently written the book Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. His book takes a hard look at Israeli authoritarian politics through a cross-section of interviews from the homes of Palestinian activists to the political leaders behind the organized assault on democratic rights. Max was speaking at a Brooklyn for Peace meeting on Israel's special relationship with the United States, the collapse of the latest peace process, what needs to be done and who's doing it, and what are the most effective tactics. Let's have a listen to excerpts from that speech.
Thank you to Brooklyn for Peace. This is my first talk in Brooklyn about my book. You know, first time anyone invited me, so I just came to see all these nice people. I lived right down the street for a while until I couldn't afford to anymore, and you know, I've been expelled from Brooklyn after failing to prove that I can make 40 times the monthly rent. I now live in Jersey City, but still kind of identify as a New Yorker, whatever that means. So it's really nice to kind of come to my ancestral homeland and talk about this issue. I want to talk about the collapse of the peace process. I want to talk about what that means for those of us who are campaigning for equal rights for Palestinians. I want to talk about Israel's response to the collapse of a peace process that has shielded it from international scrutiny and external pressure. But, you know, I follow the news and several events. Maybe it's because I have like a one-track mind and I'm just completely obsessed. Like my mother says, I'm too obsessive. That I'm obsessed with this, but they brought me back to Palestine, these news events. When I saw Jay Leno outside the Beverly Hills Hotel this week protesting because the Beverly Hills Hotel is owned by the Sultanate of Brunei and they have just implemented these very repressive anti-gay laws. And Jay Leno compared the Sultanate to Nazis and said, you know, this is just like 1933 Germany. The Holocaust is coming. Hello. I think, you know, it's better for him to do the questioning of celebrities than to do much, to do offer any of his own viewpoints. But nevertheless, the State Department, which constantly tells Palestinians, well, has told Palestinians since the beginning of John Kerry's attempt to create a framework for a framework, in his words, to just come back to the negotiating table while Israel has built 50 new settlement units a day since the beginning of the framework for the framework. The State Department has said that this boycott is legitimate, that they consider this a legitimate boycott. The State Department, which has condemned BDS. The Stanford University just divested $20 million from the coal industry, according to its code of ethics of socially responsible investment. This is the same Stanford University that denounced the American Studies Association for their boycott of Israeli educational institutions like the Technion, which are knee-deep in the occupation, which are heavily involved in the research and development sector of the occupation. And CNN has aired a powerful documentary about SeaWorld's abuse and imprisonment of wild orca whales and their exploitation of workers called Blackfish, which has led to a cultural boycott of SeaWorld, with musical acts refusing to perform at SeaWorld, and children telling their parents that they don't want to see these abused whales in captivity. And SeaWorld is bleeding profits thanks to CNN, the home of former APAC researcher Wolf Blitzer, airing this powerful documentary, muckraking journalism on an abusive, exploitative entity. And then there's the State of Israel, which has refused to take in any Syrian refugees that I know of because they're, you know, demographic threats. But just performed a dramatic and widely covered operation on a Syrian brown bear. I think they gave the brown bear back surgery, and this was covered in the international media as a sign of Israel's altruism and beneficence. And so it occurred to me that, you know, I had some ideas for Palestinians. You know, I wanted to mansplain to Palestinians for a second, that if they want to receive dignity from Israel, dignified treatment from Israel, or fair coverage from the mainstream American corporate media, if they want support from the U.S. government, from the State Department, or if they want the support of elite American institutions, there's some things they need to do. They need to wear bear suits equipped with solar panels while speaking in complex sonar blasts like orca whales while walking down the red carpet at the Oscars. I really seems to me that that's the only way that they can make that happen. Of course, there's another option, which is that, you know, those of us who support Palestinian equal rights, who are heeding the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, take matters into our own hands, because none of this stuff is going to happen until we do so and create bottom-up pressure. The conditions are just not right among American elites, among the corporate media, and within U.S. government for anything positive to happen on this issue. That's why we're here tonight. So we also need to recognize that we're here tonight at an extremely opportune time for this kind of bottom-up grassroots organizing, Palestinian-led organizing around BDS. And it's because of the collapse of the peace process, which has been going on for decades, allowing Israel to continue to put new facts on the ground, to expand its project of greater Israel, of illegal colonial settlements, of repression, of apartheid, while creating the impression in the U.S. that it is fighting for peace and that it is interested in peace, and that this occupation and that the wall and the siege of Gaza are actually temporary projects if the Palestinians would just come to the table and negotiate away their future. But that's all over. And Martin Indyk, who was the chief negotiator for the State Department, who is a former researcher for AIPAC, the key arm of the Israel lobby, who told a pro-Israel group in 2009 that he left Australia, where he's from, and moved to Washington, that he made aliyah to Washington in order to protect Israel's security imperatives. His words, this man who is really the fox guarding the hen house, who has been the fox guarding the hen house, who has been Israel's lawyer, in the words of former negotiator Aaron David Miller, who's kind of like the junior lawyer, junior partner in the law firm. Martin Indyk has come out and told the most prominent columnist in Israel, Nahum Barnea, that the peace process is over and it's all Netanyahu's fault. It's Israel's fault. Even Martin Indyk has been forced to blame Israel. He did so anonymously on speaking on background, but we all know it's him. Another U.S. official was so upset by what happened, so upset with Israel's behavior, the Netanyahu government's behavior, that he said that I guess we need another intifada to get the peace process going again. That's how desperate the U.S. has become. Emil Nakhle, who is a veteran academic, a former CIA analyst, and a member of the Palestinian intelligentsia, who is considered very conservative by other Palestinian intellectuals, because he conceived the idea of a Palestinian state in the 1970s solely in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, at a time when the PLO still believed in a kind of binational state with equal rights for all. Emil Nakhle was actually attacked by Mr. Peace Process Industry Saeb Erekat for advancing, in Erekat's words, the U.S. solution. Nakhle has come out last week and said that the two-state solution is over. There is no way that it's physically or geographically or politically possible. We should do away with it and never speak of it again. And not only that, but the whole peace process has been a sham. So from the most conservative sectors within the peace process industry, there is a solid consensus that there will not be a U.S.-led two-state solution anytime in the near future. And meanwhile, Israel continues to ethnically cleanse, continues to build settlements. What does this mean for Americans and for the U.S.? Shibli Telhami, who is, to my knowledge, the only Arab American ever to serve on a U.S. negotiating team on Israel-Palestine, and is now at the Brookings Institute, in another conservative institution, actually at the Saban Center, funded by Haim Saban, who is one of the biggest bundlers for Barack Obama, and says he's a single-issue guy. His one issue is Israel. But don't call him an Israel firster. Telhami commissioned a really interesting poll 2 months ago, conducted by a GFK, which is a very reputable polling firm. And he asked Americans, 1,000 Americans across the political spectrum, if the two-state solution is deemed to be a failure and collapses, what do you favor, a democratic single state or a Jewish state? And by a margin of 64 to 20, American respondents to this poll declared that they favored a democratic single state to a Jewish state, which simply means that they just need to be informed that the two-state solution is over, halas, and then they will come around to support the democracy that they claim to believe in their own country. Interestingly, if you look at the internals of these kinds of polls, you will find that support for democracy is heavily weighted towards those who self-identify as Democrats, members of the Democratic Party. Meanwhile, the Republican Party, which is consumed with Christian Zionism, tends to favor the Jewish state solution. They have these shared values of white nationalism and Jewish nationalism. This is a party that's rooted in neo-Confederate traditions, and sees as a beacon of light Netanyahu's Israel. And so what we're seeing play out in our elections is an incredibly undemocratic Democratic Party, which refuses to embrace the mood and attitudes, the shifting attitudes of its grassroots base as it falls increasingly under the control of corporate interests, and a Republican Party that is using Israel as a kind of wedge issue, like gay marriage and abortion, a Republican Party whose two top funders are Sheldon Adelson and Paul Singer, both extreme hardcore Zionists who place Israel as one of their paramount issues. And every candidate in the upcoming midterms and in the 2016 elections will have to kiss Sheldon Adelson, the casino baron's ring, and declare fealty to Netanyahu's Israel if they have any hope of receiving the nomination. If Rand Paul, however, receives the nomination, we could witness a bizarre exodus of neocons from the Republican Party into the camp of Hillary Clinton, who is receiving enormous support from Haim Saban and others like that. So John Kerry, who's gotten almost nothing right from Palestine to Cairo, where he said, you know, that Egypt was on the road to democracy. I mean, I don't know how many massacres it takes to convince him that, you know, massacring people isn't democracy. I mean, how many mass death sentences does it take to convince him that something terribly authoritarian is happening? Kerry actually got something right when he warned Israelis and Netanyahu and his inner circle that if the peace process flops, you will get BDS on steroids. And that's what we're going to see. And that's what we're seeing in our own communities, and that's what we're seeing on campus. And this battle in the United States, as Ali Abunema says in his essential new book, which you all should get, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, the battle will be decided on campus in the U.S., which is why the Zionist movement is investing so much of its resources to suppress protected speech on campus and actually reaching out and calling on state power to crush academic institutions like the American Studies Association to suppress Palestine solidarity activism. The argument is over. There's no argument anymore. No one is going to challenge the facts that are in my book, which just happen to be the facts on the ground. I'm not, you know, some genius. I just wrote them down after documenting them. No one has challenged the facts in my book. Eric Alterman of The Nation, after trashing my book in 9 blog posts, transforming himself into a virtual internet stalker, conceded that my book is technically factually accurate. And that's because the argument is over. There will be no argument. There is only a call, activism, and this momentum for justice in Palestine versus an aggressive fighting retreat from the Israel lobby in the U.S. And it's the U.S. that's the last bastion of pro-Israel support in the world. My book doesn't deal with the U.S., although obviously it has implications for how this will play out in the U.S. As I said before, my book is about Israel in the post-two-state solution era, in the peace process era, the post-Oslo era, what many Israelis would call the era of Hafradah, or separation, unilateral separation on demographic lines, as manifested in the separation wall and the siege of the Gaza Strip. And there are many instances of kind of micro-Hafradah within Israeli cities separating Palestinian citizens of Israel from Jews. And what I intended to do with my book was expose the reality of a Jewish ethnocracy and the illusion of a Jewish state as a democracy. Now, we've had liberal Zionists like Peter Beinart and Jeffrey Goldberg embracing this idea of liberalism and Zionism as two kinds of concepts that can exist in harmony. It's kind of like two states of mind. And right now, those are the only two states that liberal Zionists have left. The actual two states have been eviscerated, and my book addresses Israel-Palestine as a single unitary entity under the control of one apartheid regime with different matrices of domination for different populations defined according to ethnic and religious lines. Now, I don't need to tell you that Israel practices apartheid. I don't need to tell you that it discriminates on an institutional basis against anyone who is not Jewish. We can just listen to Benjamin Netanyahu, the thrice elected leader of Israel, who just introduced a new basic law in response to BDS, what he calls a tax on Israel's legitimacy, a law that will represent the funeral of liberal Zionism if it's passed.
That was author and reporter Max Blumenthal speaking recently at a Brooklyn for Peace meeting in New York City.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
With the open support of Washington and its European allies, the regime installed by Washington and Berlin in last February's fascist-led putsch is now extending its reign of terror against all popular resistance in the Ukraine. In his recent article, The Kyiv Putsch, Rebel Workers Take Power in the East, returning guest Professor Jim Petras describes the immense complexity and shifting outcomes within the NATO, U.S., and European violent seizure of the Ukraine. Professor Petras joins us to help clarify the dynamics of this conflict. Welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for the invite.
You know, it's hard to understand what exactly is going on in the Ukraine as between Europe and the United States and what's happening there in the Ukraine from just reading the major newspapers or watching television here in the United States. So that's why we're so glad to have you on the show, Jim. Can you give us a background of the situation, and then we'll talk about an update?
The Ukraine had a kind of oligarchical electoral system, which competing oligarchs competed in the electoral arena. And one set of oligarchs was closer to the NATO powers, and one set was closer to Russia, more or less pursuing a kind of non-aligned foreign policy. This came to a head recently. I believe it was in February. They started major riots and violent confrontations. The opposition, backed by NATO, overthrew the government in a coup d'etat, seized power, and the U.S. Undersecretary for Foreign Affairs, Victoria Nuland, appointed the president and the prime minister, who then formed a coalition government with neo-fascists, openly embracing the heritage of the Nazi collaborators. These people then proceeded to try to impose a different kind of policy, different kind of orientation to the country, essentially aligning it with NATO and trying to undercut any kind of pluralism and diversity which existed in Ukraine up to then, particularly bilingualism in the eastern part of the country, a greater degree of representation. So they moved ahead and outlawed essentially the pro-Russian speaking minority, and that provoked people in the East who were long-time critics of centralism and the imposition of policies from the West, from Kiev. So the Kiev junta then sent military groups out there to repress them culminating with the neo-fascists going to Odessa and incinerating 40 people that were taking refuge in a trade union center. The whole impetus for this crisis was the coup d'etat and the violence surrounding it and the consequent highly repressive, centralized policies that ensued. The consequences are enormous. Ukraine's main industrial trading partner is Russia. Its main source of gas and energy is Russia. And these dictators began to break off relations, which would bring enormous harm to Ukraine. You have to realize that the dynamic sectors of the country are in the east. There's the steel, coal, the most productive sector of the country. They pay a disproportionate amount of taxes and get very little in return. So there's a very much a regional hostility here. And the issue has nothing to do with being pro-Russia. It's a question of the people in the east opposing a military takeover, a junta. They oppose a government appointed by foreign powers. They oppose the outlawing of bilingualism, and they want to return to having good trade relations with Russia as well as the East. And the authoritarians in the East want to break with Russia. They wanted initially to turn the Russian bases over to NATO. Russia preempted that in the Crimea. So essentially, it's a struggle between workers in the East, mainly steel and manufacturing workers, some of the rich farming areas, versus a foreign-appointed dictatorship. That's what the issue is. It has nothing to do with the so-called transition government. The Western account is absolutely bizarre. About the incineration of the pro-Democrats in Odessa, the BBC, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, Washington Post, the supposedly respectable press, talk about it as a conflict between pro and anti-Russian forces. This is the most bizarre thing that I've ever come across. When videos clearly show these writers from Kiev firebombing the building and smashing heads of people who survived jumping out of second, third-story buildings. And the cover-up of the massacre incineration is comparable to what the Nazi press did when Hitler was incinerating Jews, telling people they were just taking showers.
Yes, and a second incident happened just last week in Mariupol, and the U.S. spokeswoman, Jen Psaki, blamed opponents of the Kiev regime, and she said, quote, "Well, we condemn the outbreak of violence caused by pro-Russian separatists this morning in Mariupol, which has resulted in multiple deaths."
Got incinerated beyond recognition. It was the women, the pensioners, and the adolescents that they found among the ashes. The whole Western press has lined up in the most, I would compare it to the worst period of McCarthyism in the Cold War, let's say 1950-51. This is the kind of reportage we got at that time, and that's what we're getting now. There's absolutely no relationship to what is going on. And the fact is that the Kiev dictatorship can't even count on its own troops. It sends troops over there, and they start fraternizing with their own people. So they have to send special forces, and they've recently got a big inflow of mercenaries from what used to be called Blackwater Mercenary Outfit. They call themselves Academy now, and there's over 400 of them who were shipped into the eastern part of the country to do the dirty work that the Ukrainian soldiers are resisting. And I think this is an indication of how isolated this government is and how much the demands for democracy and maintaining industry and resisting the IMF, how much fear they have of the contagion. The democratic self-determination agenda of the East resonates with people in the West. There's no Great Wall of China separating the East and West when it comes to issues of economic improvement and democratic representation.
What do you think ultimately the United States' aim is with respect to both the Ukraine and more broadly with respect to Russia?
Well, they've been building ever since the end of the Soviet Union. You have the West breaking promises they made that they would not extend NATO to Russia's border, and they broke every single promise. I think we have in from the Baltic Sea through Central Europe and to the Balkans, and now they're trying to extend it into the Caucasus. The idea of encircling Russia and then pressing it from the outside and trying to hook up with the pro-Western minority in Russia, the elite that fronts for the U.S. Essentially, their idea is to turn Russia into a vassal state. What happened with Yeltsin in the 90s, where Russia was pillaged of over $1 trillion in resources and companies and banks, and the people in Russia lost 5 years in life expectancy during that miserable decade. That's what their ideal is. Their ideal is to return Russia to vassal stage, to misery, poverty, powerlessness, in order to be able to exploit Russia itself and also to weaken any diplomatic counterpoints from Russia. That's their ideal. That's what they want. The same thing with China. They're encircling China with bases all over the Pacific now, provoking conflicts. They want China to be a very second-rate power like it was in the 80s and when China was just starting its growth trajectory and was very timid and compliant as it turned toward opening to the market. And they want to do the same thing. They don't want a powerful, competitive economy that's displacing them in Latin America and Asia. So this military strategy, it's either rule or ruin. Let's face it. Washington hasn't been able to rule in some of these contexts. Let's take a look at their policy in Iraq, Afghanistan. They destroyed those countries. Millions of casualties, industries destroyed, scientists driven abroad. So the result was Washington could build a satellite regime, and they abandoned it, and as they'll abandon Afghanistan in its total misery. And the same thing they did in Libya. They bombed Libya into the Stone Age. They overthrew a progressive nationalist welfarist regime in Gaddafi, and they left it in tatters. Libya is beyond belief today. It's run by gangsters, Islamists, jihadists, bandits, thugs, anybody that Washington could mobilize to overthrow their enemy, and then they walk away.
What conclusion would you draw from Bush being a Republican and Obama being a Democrat?
Well, I think Obama took it one step forward. I think you have to say that Obama has precipitated more direct conflicts in more areas of the world in a deeper sense than even Bush, and Bush was an absolute nightmare. We have this wars in Syria. We have the U.S. intervening in Libya. You have the U.S. propping up the military dictatorship in Egypt. You have the U.S. backing Israel's huge settlement policies. You have the U.S. engaging now in the Caucasus, which I doubt any other American president would have tried the power grab. I mean, let's face it, the Ukrainian government, before the U.S. organized the coup and made the big power grab to turn Ukraine into another NATO base, the idea was a right-wing pro-capitalist regime that was playing a role that related both to the West and to the East. They traded with the U.S. Huge investors from U.S. Were buying up land in the Ukraine. Even Biden's son was involved in oil deals there. etc. And they didn't want that. They want it all. They wanted Ukraine to turn into a satellite to put missiles on Russia's border. That kind of extremism, I think, has pushed the U.S. political spectrum so far to the right now that we have to start rethinking all the politics of trying to realign the Democratic Party and work with the good guys against the bad. That's in shambles. The entire Democratic Party has moved with Obama with a few window dressing figures, and I think it's raised the question of what happened to the peace movement that went into the Democratic Party to support Obama. What happened to the justice movement that was looking for a U.S. to make a peace dividend? These things have been lost by truckling to the Democrats, de Blasio in New York, Obama in Washington. I think we have to rethink our political agenda.
What did you make of CIA head John Brennan, Vice President Joe Biden, John McCain, all going to the Ukraine?
Well, when you have a puppet regime, you have, listen, the U.S. claims, and I believe them, that they poured $5 billion into the Ukraine since the 90s. So they have bought themselves a good chunk of the political class, if not the totality. They have NGOs, non-government organizations. They bought party leaders. They hired political thugs from the neo-Nazis. So there's a lot to choose from there, and a lot of people who are willing to eat out of whoever comes from the United States' hand. So that kind of ambiance encourages U.S. politicians to go over there for photo ops because you got the monkey standing on your shoulder.
When you envision some kind of realignment to the United States and no longer supporting Democrats who appear to be liberal, where does this change come from? What would you advise people who...
Well, I think we have to rethink. I think there's a lot of grassroots organizations that are around, a tremendous amount of people that are very hostile to the Wall Street bailout, the enormous inequalities, a certain disenchantment with the whole idea that Obama represents minorities. He's persecuted more immigrants than any president in the history of the United States, probably expelled, forcibly seized close to 2 million people in his years in office, which is about three times what his predecessors have done. So I think there's a whole group of people in different positions. Wall Street Occupy movement was a flare-up. The tremendous deluge against the initial bailout by Gethner. The public opinion polls show that Obama's foreign policy has about 15% support. 85% people are opposed it. 70% were against the bailout, and I probably think more. So on public opinion, on what people think, we have an enormous audience. The trouble is that they don't connect that with organization, political or social. And I think that's where the commitments have to come from running local candidates and building on what exists there. We are the mainstream as far as real opinion, real thoughts, real interests of people. And I don't think we're imputing this. This is what people articulate today. It's a question of a new generation of people coming out of different sectors. The so-called labor unions represent 8% of the private sector today. 92% are outside of that. We have elections in Seattle where some openly socialist candidates actually get elected in citywide elections. I think the problem is you have a whole mishmash of organizations like the Working People's Party in New York, the so-called liberal left in New York, the Democratic Socialists and all these forums. They talk to each other. They think they're doing politics, but none of them have built up any independent constituencies. They got sucked into de Blasio's campaign. and he appoints more holdovers from Bloomberg than any predecessor Democrat does. I mean, there's so many people talking left but not talking to the organization. I mean, this left forum brings 4,000 or 5,000 academics to read to each other and think they're doing politics. It's. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it's certainly not contributing to creating alternatives to imperialist and capitalist Wall Streeters.
So if people want to follow the unfolding events in the Ukraine and they don't care for the reports in the New York Times or CBS, where do you get your news on these?
Well, I get my news from RT, the Russian-based outfit that comes across. I get stuff from Information Clearinghouse, Common Dreams. There are a lot of alternative sources that you can tap in the internet, and that's where I get most of my information. And that's the only place to go. I was a subscriber to the Financial Times for many years, and it's degenerated into a pro-war rag. I tell them, you're no longer the Financial Times, you're the Military Times, because they support wars that actually disrupt markets.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, how are you going to tell people to invest in Iraq, Iran, when you're calling for sanctions, when you invade and destroy the economic base of the country, when you're supporting wars in Syria, Lebanon, Libya? You're totally undermining the financial operations of major enterprises.
Well said. Professor James Petras, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and we'll continue to check in with you, and we appreciate your wisdom on this. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and keep up the good work, Michael. A splendid book on envisioning socialism. It's a splendid book. Thank you very much for sending me a copy.
Well, thank you. Take it easy.
Okay. Right. Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.